Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Erica. I am delighted that you're my guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. It sounds like you're a regular listener. I don't hear that a whole lot. Maybe I'm going to hear that with more regularity. I like hearing that you've been listening for a long time. Before we dive into our topic of conversation, which you're familiar with, we're going to let you sort of drive the conversation this morning. But before we let you do that, how about you just tell us who you are? Where do we find you in the world?
Yeah, so my name is Erica Ellis, and I am currently a senior gift officer at the local chapter of Make-A-Wish here in Central and Western North Carolina.
Where is it? Tell us where on the map there. I know North Carolina. I've got in-laws out on the Outer Banks, and I know Charlotte. I know Raleigh, those sorts of. Where exactly are you at on the map?
So our main office is located in Charlotte, but our chapter is 51 counties, and we do Central and Western North Carolina. So we go from Greensboro all the way over to Asheville, up into the mountains, and then down towards Charlotte and below Charlotte a little.
So you're like road tripping in a post COVID sort of world reality. You're driving all over the state of North Carolina. Am I right?
Exactly. But the crazy part is I started this job literally the week that everything shut down.
So you have had to, so are you that type of individual who sort of comes to the table with major gift experience, knows how to do the lunch table, knows how to do the coffee table, but now is learning how to take those same skills? Because a lot of people are asking me, I've got clients who are routinely asking me things like, well, what do we do now? And I'm like, you don't really do anything differently. You take those same skills that you used at the lunch table, at the coffee shop, and you put them on Zoom. I mean, is that essentially what you're doing now?
Exactly. That's essentially what I'm doing now. I think the trickiest part with starting this job is obviously everything that we were dealing with COVID, and the unknown is how do we approach donors? And then on top of it, I had an extra bonus, which was we had no CEO at the time. Right. And so we didn't have anyone to help me kind of make those introductions. So it was, when I say it was cold calling, people just to make introductions. And I'll be honest with you, it was really hard in the beginning because everyone had so much going on. And so I think that's really when I started listening to you and a lot of others just to try to figure out, how do I get in with some of these donors right now, being the brand new person they've never talked to or heard from? A lot of change has happened at the chapter. So it was just, how do I get in front of these folks? And I think part of it was just a little bit of time and grace with some of them. But also being willing to your point, pick up the phone, make some Zoom calls, do whatever it took to just to get in front of people.
Do you think, here's one of my concerns, and then we'll dive into the topic of the day. But one of my concerns about sort of where we find ourselves right now is that I think some organizations that are historically very entrenched in what I call arm's length fundraising, sort of that lane one fundraising, you know, are going to think that COVID and sort of this era of social distancing just gives them the rationale and the reasoning to sort of double down on that. And they're going to, so I think they're going to sort of, they're going to become all the more disadvantaged than they were even before COVID. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because, and I think it's going to be even harder for organizations that know how to employ gift officers, because am I right when I, and understand I'm doing a lot of coaching, but I'm not generally on in your seat doing the major gift work right now as a, we'll call you a Zoom officer, right?
Right.
It has to be more emotionally, I mean, a coffee shop and a lunch table, for example, even an office setting or a living room offers so much more distraction, so much more layering. This is hard work, is it not?
It is. It is really hard work. And I agree with you. I do worry that that organizations that are especially used to the event fundraising, that's what this organization was used to.
Yeah.
Might think that they need to double down once we can get in-person events back on events just to get things back rolling. But what I will say is this organization before COVID happened realized that they were already tipping that point. Like they needed to start actually building these relationships with these donors. And so I'm hoping, I don't know about you, but I'm hoping that COVID makes us realize that we need to double down on the relationship side of things. I know that Make-A-Wish, I'm really excited, but that's the stance that Make-A-Wish is doing. We are, as a national organization, even though we're all federated chapters, doing our own thing, it's really become a big emphasis on relationship building with our
donors. Yeah. I think what we're going to see, Erica, is in the next 12 months, some of this social distancing stuff. I think I just read an article earlier this week, a large corporation, I think they're based in Germany or something, is basically sort of telling the world, you never have to come back to work ever again. It's kind of like what the social media companies were saying 6 and 9 months ago. You know, Twitter was saying that, you know, people are going to work remotely. I think we're going to see in the fundraising space and the nonprofit sector, just this realization that the world really has changed. But I had a guest on here, I don't know, a week or two ago, who was sort of talking about, in reality, all of us have sort of been building up to this for 2 decades. We've been, you know, we've been using these platforms, and now we've actually realized that we truly have to relinquish control. We truly have to trust our employees. You know, we've got to let Erica work from her living room or wherever she's comfortable doing it. Because in reality, if I can get Erica, if I can get you in front of a major donor, where you happen to be sitting in the world really doesn't matter to me right now. If you know how to have that meaningful conversation with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you can do it. You can do it anywhere you want to, right? I mean, I think that's the, so I think that whole control paradigm that sort of dates all the way back to the Industrial Revolution and sort of when we thought we could sort of run these machines just has sort of gone out the window. And maybe some of the aspirations that we collectively want for ourselves are, we're just going to live up to them. Don't you think?
Yeah. No, you took the words right out of my mouth. I actually have the same exact notes in here. As I think that we as fundraisers need to realize we're going to have to go to our donors where, meet them where they are. So whether that be on Zoom or at their home or their lunch table or whatever it may be. But I think what we're going to see is a lot more education coming out about how to do proper Zoom calls, Zoom etiquette skills. I have a feeling that's going to be trickling down to the fundraising world. I haven't seen a whole lot of that yet, but I think that's going to be the next big thing. Because I think we have to be comfortable getting on Zoom calls. And I'll be the first one to admit, in the beginning, I was like, that's strange. I don't know if I feel okay doing a video call. But after the first couple, it's just like doing phone calls. After the first couple, you're like, yeah, this is perfect.
Right. So yeah. I've got any day I'll have 150 to 300 fundraising professionals listening to this this conversation. So what do you want them to hear this week?
Yeah, I guess, you know, you asked me for something bold, and I think I was struggling with that, right? And I think I came up with four different things that I personally think, and this may be cliche, but what I think that I have found in my career that is important to have as characteristics. And for me, that has also proven to be the fact that's got me through this last 10 months of this new job in this new world. One of them is passion. I'm huge on this. I had a board member once tell me, Erica, when you talk to me, you don't talk to me about my donation. You talk to me about the kids.
Yeah.
And for me, that's always meant the most to me and what has made me want to give more.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's, you can't sit behind a desk. You've got to be part of the mission. You got to be willing to go out there. If you're at a school, talk to the kids. If you're in a, you know, homeless organization, go out and talk to the folks you're feeding or housing. And it's not just about telling their story, but it's for you to be able to share that with your donors. It's got to be more than just sharing with them the revenue, the line items.
Yeah.
So I think that to me is huge. You know, the other thing is grit. I think more now than ever, we have to be willing to buckle down and we have to be willing to persevere through some of these hard things. You're not going to get every donor on the phone. And I think this goes to some of this younger generation. I think from my experience, they get very frustrated, or they're willing to just let go or give up if they don't get the first couple phone calls that go the way they were hoping. And I think for all of us that have been doing this a while, that's important for us to make sure they understand is that they gotta be willing to keep picking up the phone. I think that I have
I don't think anybody has used that word grit on the, we're 200 and plus, we're 220 episodes into this. And I think we know what grit means in maybe a general sense. And some of us have read Duckworth's book, for example, or something, but what does in your mind, what does grit mean for the person in your seat? And let's take it out of the context of COVID-19. We've talked a lot about COVID-19 for the last 45 episodes or so. What does grit look like when we do achieve some degree of normalcy, say late in the fall or something, and we get back to sort of business as usual, whatever that means? What does grit usually look like?
Yeah. Well, that's funny too, that you just said that back to normal, because I think it's never going to be back to normal to our point earlier. It's back to a new normal.
A new normal, right. So let's say we get into that new normal. And there's something other than, like I work with clients, for example, Erica, who can't schedule their meetings 2 weeks out. They don't know how to use a deliberate practice of always, they're always sort of on the fly. And I think grit is starting to build into our patterns and habits. Things like, look, if the donor's not willing to schedule 2 weeks out, chances are they're not generous with their time. Chances are they're really not engaged in this. And chances are you need to move them off your list and move on to somebody else. But you've got to be able to sort of create those discerning, what other people call deliberate practices. I like to put the word discernment in front of that. What is that grit for you?
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I think for me, it's to what I was just saying. It's not giving up. To me, I think I said this to you, and you and I were going back and forth earlier. I've worked at a lot of different places, national organizations. The last place I worked was a local organization, very grassroots. And I always feel like all of these organizations have tried to start by finding this golden goose who's going to lay this golden egg. Like, that's what we're going to spend all of our time and wheels and spin all of them on. And meanwhile, I've always been the one to kind of come in and be like, wait a second, who do we have right now in our system? I understand we want to get in front of Bill Gates or whoever the big name
is. The same fella or the same gal that everybody else in town's trying to pursue.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But meanwhile, what are we doing to steward and build relationships with the donors that are in our system? And we're forgetting about them. So grit to me is like doubling down. You got to find what we have in our system, and you got to be willing to be on the phone and make those conversations. And also understand that most of them haven't been talked to in a while, in my experience, from the organization, outside of being asked at the last event. And so you've got to be willing to put the work in to build that relationship. And unfortunately, a lot of times, in my experience, higher ups are not willing to give you that time to build the proper relationship. They want the ask to be made. But I do think grit is also pushing back a little on that.
Right.
At a certain point in your career, you've got to be willing to push back a little bit on those people that are pushing you to make an ask before you and your gut is ready to make it.
How many years into your fundraising career are you?
So I think about 12 is where 12. I'm at.
Now. Okay. So when I wrote the first book, I was writing to the individual that was about 10 years in. So it was the individual like yourself who was getting a little weary of the sort of the mechanics of fundraising. They were tired of going to the seminars and hearing the same old, same old. I mean, they had been to every grant writing, direct response, every event planning seminar that they possibly could go to. And they wanted to think more carefully and critically about what it is we're doing. And I mean, isn't part of grit? I think I've got a copy of Duckworth's book on my iPhone. I don't have it in hard copy, but I've certainly read it. Isn't some of what grit is that ability to sort of sit back and pause and contemplate what it is we're doing? And I don't know that we're affording ourselves that bandwidth in our head. I think we're thinking about a lot of other things. Like I posted the broadcast that we broadcast this morning, and I'll hop up on this really this soapbox for a moment, and then I'll get down and let you talk. So I think right before COVID sort of was happening, we were addressing some of these sort of universal inequities and marginalizations and issues that were sort of, we were talking about mental health and we were talking about, you know, power structures. And we were talking about a lot of the issues that are really problematic in our world today. But what we also weren't doing is we weren't addressing some of the things that are truly characteristic of what it is to do fundraising. Like you're never going to level the playing field with that super wealthy, over, you know, arrogant jerk major donor who generally happens to be an older white guy. You're never going to level the playing field with him if you won't sit across the lunch table with him. I mean, isn't that really the truth about it? If you won't take the time to schedule a meeting with him, get out of your comfort zone, and perhaps sort of inadvertently put him in his place, I don't know that we're going to ever get on the other side of some of these issues that I think we think are so problematic. Am I right?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You're right. And I think there's, you know, at my last organization, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but we did Benevon.
Yeah,
and I know Benevon. But the one thing I took, the biggest thing I took away from them is the bless and release quote.
Perfect idea. Yes.
Bless and release. You have to understand. And I think that's too, it's not just the donor either. It's knowing at a certain point in your career that if you don't feel comfortable with decisions that are being made or the direction an organization is going, to me, I've had to say bless and release to that. Like I've had to move on, and I've had circumstances where, you know, there's been, I see a way a donor should be treated, but the organization is not treating them the way they need to be treated. And I've had to, like, it's time. Like, I don't feel, as a fundraiser, I don't feel morally and ethically correct about this.
Yeah.
So it's time for me to start looking elsewhere. And we have to be okay with that, or we have to be willing to kind of stand up and say, to your point, we have to be that voice in the room sometimes to stand up to both the donor side of things and the other side, the board, the CEOs, and say, you know, this doesn't feel right. And if they're not okay with it and if they won't listen to your reason, then it might be time to move on and look for other places, unfortunately.
Help me develop this concept for a minute, because I think you and I are pretty much on the same page on this. So, you know, this centricity stuff that we talk about, the idea of sort of donor-centered this or whatever. The word centered always shows up, and there's a couple of ways to put this stuff. And I think what I'm starting to realize is that when the story tells you to put anyone at the center of anything in a complex, messy, unpredictable world like this, ultimately you're going to make somebody feel exploited because they're not at the center of this. And so I think what has happened is the concept I'm trying to develop for this new book is this idea of sort of this centricity effect. Because we see this in consumer. I worked for Sears when I was in college, and I remember in college they had a customer centricity notion. It was the idea that the customer was always right. Well, there were plenty of instances where we realized the customer was not always right. They were being obnoxious. We were never going to make them happy. And then sometimes we had to do what Benevon would tell you to do. You had to bless and release them. You had to send them on your way, and you had to become, what most importantly, you had to be convinced that you could sell a damn dishwasher to somebody else. I mean, that was kind of it was like, do you realize you can sell that appliance to somebody else? You really don't have to kiss their rear end for that long. And I think this centricity notion that we've built into our thinking, we've inherited from consumer sciences, if you will. And as a result, we're also leaving. So if you've got the donor centered at anything, you're going to have your employees, your volunteers. Somebody's going to feel like they're being left out. What's your thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. It's one of the concepts that I've listened in your podcast that really, because I was the one, the fundraiser that doubled down on donor-centric thinking. And yeah. It wasn't until I started hearing some of your podcasts and talking about that and reading about it, that it made me really step back and think, you're absolutely right. And I've seen that happen, to your point, at organizations where we're putting our major donors or our donors in general over the volunteers who are putting just as much time and love into the organization. You know, it's funny. I think it goes back to that grit, and you have to be willing to double down and say, okay, that donor is going to get blessed and released, but I've got 10 more that I need to reach out to now to make up for it or whatever. And doubling down on the folks that do have the true passion. I think that's the biggest thing that, you know, Benevon really pushes. If that donor does not showcase passion for the mission.
Yeah.
And we all know what that looks like at the end of the day. If you've been doing fundraising long enough, you know the difference between a donor who is doing it for the passion points or for, you know, the tax write-off or for the name recognition. I mean, you learn those things as you're working with donors.
Does it take grit to do the bless and release? Because in some ways, to bless and release, and I don't think Benevon came up with this either. I mean, I think there's a lot of context where blessing and releasing is something. I think there's some history behind that great idea that they've sort of tapped into. Doesn't it hurt a little bit of our ego to send a donor on their way and say, you're not in love with our mission. You're never going to give at a level that's, justifies your time or my time. We're always going to be in this relatively dysfunctional codependent relationship where neither one of us is ever going to get anything out of this in a meaningful way. Isn't that what the grit you're talking about is to say, go and fall in love with another organization and let me go fall in love with a donor where we can honor each other, not put either of us at the center of anything, not put anybody up on a pedestal. Isn't that what grit really is?
Absolutely. Especially if you're talking to a board member or CEO who's like, what do you mean bless and release? Like, we're not doing that with, you know, that donor. But yeah, I definitely do think so. And I think it goes back to, you know, to your point, it can be really hard when we're in a profession that does work off metrics. And there's a lot of organizations that still want you to meet very specific metrics. I will tell you, it's been very hard the last 10 months to think even about blessing and releasing anyone, because we're in a situation where we need to get support right now. We are hurting. And that's not even a concept, but I think it goes back to what do we do in the meantime then? Like, is it putting them into different categories and saying, to your point, I know that this donor is not going to be that passion donor, and I'm going to treat them a little bit differently than I'm going to treat the one that needs to hear the stories, that wants to hear the stories, that wants to see the impact. And there's some that just don't need that and don't want it.
I'm starting to develop. So I came across this concept with an author in Canada who writes for the business school, one of the big business schools in Toronto. He's talking about this notion of what's called surrogation. It's this idea that we sort of put these surrogates, these alternative metrics into our system as indicators of what it is we're looking for. And I'm starting to sort of develop my thinking, and I'm sort of hinging on some of the things that we're talking about here. Have we mistakenly put the renewal rate, for example, at the center of what we're doing, perhaps aligned it with things like donor centricity, and come out on the other side? And we're starting to realize that some of this mixture, this surrogation, as this author would say, it's really not an indication of a particularly healthy system. I don't want to renew the relationship that's not going anywhere, right? I really don't give a damn about the relationship with a donor, and the donor that they don't really give a damn about me, that doesn't want to go anywhere. And so renewing something that's not going to go anywhere is not blessing and releasing. I just recently read a book about the Notre Dame studies. We talked about this on a previous podcast as well. The Notre Dame studies, the generosity studies that they did about a decade ago, basically came to the conclusion that about 50% of our population wants to be generous, and about 50% of our population doesn't. And so if we bless and release the 50% of our population that doesn't want to be generous, your renewal rate's about right. You know, mm-hmm. Your renewal rate's at about 50%. Maybe a 50% renewal rate's not bad if you're actually renewing the support of people who want to be generous. What do you think?
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. I do think when you're looking at the practicality of it, though, that's where it's hard, because, you know, as much as I want to be that bold person and be that person who's like, I'm ready to just focus in on these folks and bless and release, it's hard when you're in this arena and right now things are hard and things are tough and you're losing event money, and you do need that renewal rate to be up there.
Is it hard because you're in your role now, and is it going to be easier when you're creating the metric? Because I'm looking at you, and you've heard me say this, if you've listened to the podcast, I'm getting really excited about the Ericas that I talk to, because your boots are on the ground, you're in the field, you're doing the work. But in 5 years, you're actually going to be supervising a team of Ericas. And so is it uncomfortable now, but perhaps are we actually building something that's going to be in a much better place 5 years out?
Right. I hope so. I mean, I have a team under me right now of three.
You've got a team. Right. Yeah. So you have that opportunity to drive some of these metrics. Yeah. So it's not somebody over your head's metrics. You're sort of squeezed, but I'm guessing you're squeezed in between metrics that are sort of coming down and metrics that you're trying to very holistically sort of encourage your people on the ground. Yeah, I totally get that. But I mean, isn't that... I guess what I'm asking there is, are you more optimistic when we get into that new normal, are you more optimistic about where we're going? And if we combine grit and maybe some new definitions, do you think we'll be okay?
I think this COVID has forced us all. And I think that's what I was trying to say earlier. I think every place I've ever started has come from running events, and they've gotten to a certain level, or they were clearly just dependent on one source of revenue, whether it be corporate money, event money, or whatever. Yeah. And I've kind of always been that person to come in and be like, okay, that's good, but we need to figure out where we can drive some other revenue. And it's really taking what's already happening and diving deep into it. So the way that I think that is COVID's going to change is it's forced all of us to go in back into our database and figure out what's already there, not this constant acquisition wheel. It's about taking what we've already have, if you have it, and figuring out how to build those relationships. For me, my staff, if we haven't been on the phone this entire time, then we haven't been doing our job. And really, I have some young staff, young and green. And the biggest push for us is thanking our donors and then, you know, getting on the phone and introducing ourselves and talking to them about what's going on. And I'm an honest person when I talk to my donors. I'm bringing all the ugly with the good.
Sure.
And I'm laying it out there for them, because if I only am telling them the wishes that are happening right now and not telling them about all the backlog and what we need coming up, or that staff is being furloughed or whatever it may be that's happening to you at your organization, then you're not painting the whole picture for them. And I think that's really important. Like, we got to paint the whole picture right now for them, and we got to dig in deep. We got to be willing to go into our database and do the hard work of finding out who's already in there.
So what are you doing? Let's talk about the brass tacks of sort of that aspiration. I think there's a lot of names in a lot of databases that have been there for a long time, and they're sort of caught up in I call it sort of warming up an existing constituency. It's sort of the way that when we work with clients, we refer to sort of just warming up of a donor that you already have. So you have to be convinced that you have those assets, that those opportunities are there. And then you have to warm up, or in some way sort of morph the culture. It's that age old sort of idea that we hear in fundraising, where you pick up the phone with the donor and the donor sort of says something like, "I've been giving to you for 10 years. Why are you calling me now?" Do you think that we have, like, these young fundraisers that you're working with, for example, are these young fundraisers sort of willing to tolerate some of the perhaps dysfunction that we've sort of embedded into our systems, and willing to help us sort of renew the culture, if you will, because you have the Mrs. Smiths and the Mr. Johnsons in your current database. And the person who's going to take that hit is not your board. It's not your boss. It's John and Brenda, or whoever's on your team, who are calling them up and hearing that sort of, do they have that type of grit? Are you following me?
Yeah. I think it's definitely something that needs to be built up a little bit more. And I do think that's where it's all. I mean, we have our weekly, every other week catch-ups. And part of the idea is to talk through some of those difficult calls, because they are so green, and we talk through them and this is how we could have flipped it. This is how we can have this conversation differently. Yeah. And I also think, I don't know if this is just what I've seen so far, but I think there's a lot of, I'm huge on AFP and on listening to whoever you can listen to grow that education aspect. And I think right now there's just been a lot of just digging in and trying to get the work done, versus trying to also, on the other side of things, making sure you're educating yourself on how to have those difficult conversations.
I remember when I was 26. So we'll assume one of those members of your team are 26. And I had a recent guest, Karen. Karen was one of my previous guests. The conversation broadcast just a couple weeks ahead of this one. We were talking about emotional maturity. And I remember when I was 26 in a fundraising role and thinking that everything that I was able to sort of, all the mess and dysfunction that I was, this is sort of where I'm getting at here, all that mess and dysfunction that I was sort of able to identify, I thought was sort of the end of the world. And I think there's a lot of 26 to say 30-year-olds who are perhaps working with a leader like yourself, who also works for a board and a boss, who knows that the system is somewhat flawed, But at the end of the day, I just need you to sort of stop whining and complaining. We get it. It's broken. We're trying to fix it. And I need you to have the grit to do that. I mean, isn't that kind of where our profession's really at? And, yeah. and maybe that's a condition of what it is to do fundraising, especially as you think about generational sort of turnover and stuff. You're always going to have new people, new donors, new expectations. You just can't have that 26-year-old constantly sort of trying to diagnose the problem that we have long diagnosed, and we're just trying to rebuild it, and it takes time. Isn't that right. It too?
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I don't know about you, but when I was 26 doing this, I mean, I think that was, I was just like thrown into the pond and said,
yeah, me too.
And I didn't really even have that leadership or anyone giving me that skill. And it was me who just kind of was like, same thing. Like, I'm just going to start calling people and talking to people. And I remember my aha moment in fundraising. I think it was a letter I wrote to a gentleman who gave us $500.
Yeah.
I researched him, found out he was a Hollywood documentary producer, wrote him a letter. And just said, you know, I have noticed what you did. I've noticed the documentaries that you've created. I think, you know, I'm touched by what you did and would love to chat with you on how that passion can come over to what we're doing here at the National Center. And he called me like a week later. He called me and said, no one in the 20 plus years that I have been giving has ever researched me to find out who I was. And to put that in a context of thanking me for my donation.
Yeah.
What can I do to help you? How can I help right. your organization more? And I think I found the same thing, you know, here. It's just, I found a guy this year on LinkedIn. He yeah. hasn't given in two years. He was frustrated with the organization because all he got was letters in the mail. Found him on LinkedIn and he said, you know what? You picked up the phone, you called me.
Yeah.
I want to support you because I think people need to be supported. And I also love the organization. So what is it you need? And I think that's the thing, right? Like you gotta be bold too. And you gotta just jump in sometimes especially when you're young and you have no one kind of walking alongside you. You're just kind of thrown out there. You gotta be willing to be bold and just, yeah. All right, I'm just going to do it. And I think even now I'm at the point in my career now where it's like, you know what? I'm just going to do it and right. ask for forgiveness later, you know, like right. I'm just going to go out and do it. And if I ask the wrong person or I ask them the wrong way, then someone will let me know. That was the other saying at my last office at a colleague that was just like, we'll ask for forgiveness later. Like,
but. You know, that's an interesting thought to sort of wrap up on. And maybe that's part of that grit. Because I think that's the underlying, we never know where these conversations, we jump yeah. into the conversation, we never would know where these things are going to go. But I like to always sort of pull out the more robust and new part of the conversation, this notion of grit. But maybe that's part of where we need to, as leaders, boards, bosses, senior directors, whoever we are, supervising people, we need to recognize that young people, I'm there. I mean, I'm right there. I'm 42 years old. I'll be 43 years old this year. And in the midst of everything that's happened in the last 4 years, I have to say, politically, socially, economically, my business, my personal, you know, raising teenagers, I have to say, I'm sort of at that place in life where I'll ask for forgiveness later. And I'm not going to spend the second half of my adult life, you know, I'm not going to spend the next 40 years, you know, knock on wood, I'm able to live that long. I'm not going to spend the next 40 years not jumping into some things. And I think we've got a lot of 26-year-olds that, you know, to go back to like Karen's comment on the previous podcast, at the point at which they sort of achieve that level of emotional maturity, they're still going to bring with them that attitude. And maybe we need to be able to discern the difference between what seems like a sort of an immature, you know, sort of attitude versus, hey, I'll ask for forgiveness later.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's the key, right? To your point is there's gotta be a balance, especially at that age. And I'm seeing that now, you know, I have the big thinkers or the ones that want to do the next big idea out there in fundraising and the next platform or the next
revolutionize thing. It all, right?
Yeah, and I think I've said like, listen, I've done numerous different platforms in my career. I'm done learning a new platform, but go and show me a plan or tell me how we're going to use it and it's going to be successful, and then we'll talk about it. Yeah. And I think that's the key, right? It's got to be a balance. But at the same time, I'm also pushing them because it's like, you just sent 5 emails, but I need you to pick up the phone 5 times because an email is very different than a phone. And you got to start with a phone call and follow up with an email. Yeah. And so that's been key. It's just a balance right now. But also, I think we, as a profession, we have to have some grit, and we have to be bold sometimes in order to your point, to really kind of change the ship on what's been going on in this profession.
Yeah. I mean, I'm critiquing, and you listen to the podcast enough to know I'm constantly critiquing those who I would sort of hold responsible for sort of building that machine that, you know, has sort of existed in such a way where that gentleman wasn't getting a phone call and having a meaningful conversation for 20 years. But I guess what I'm also trying to do here on the podcast is really celebrate those aha moments. And I think that's because I had that same moment very early in my career, first job. I was only at that organization for 4 years. So somewhere in those 4 years, Mr. Wallace walks in the door. You've probably heard a lot of my guests have heard me talk about Mr. Wallace, comes in the door with a check that couldn't have been more than about $10,000. And and he's a gentleman who's probably 70 plus years old. He's writing this extraordinary gift. His son is with him, who's probably in his late 30s, early 40s. And I had been taking this gentleman out to lunch, routinely driving up. We go to this local steakhouse. And the joy that you could, this was right before Christmas, the joy you could see on his face, the joy you could see on his son's face for having been able to help his dad facilitate this gift. And the joy that I experienced having been able to sort of build a meaningful relationship with this gentleman and receive this gift and not have it feel like I was some sort of a, you know, sleazy used car salesperson or something. That was real meaningful work. We all felt recognized and appreciated and admired for what we sort of contributed in that moment. And I think the other thing that helped me, and this sort of gets about the idea of like culture, because it isn't the grit. We'll wrap up on this thought. He walked in the door and my colleagues sort of saw this play out. I mean, isn't grit also sort of the outcome of a culture, sort of an environment that has grit? It can't just be us individuals. I have to imagine that we sort of collectively create grit within a culture. Am I right?
Right. And I think, to your point, that relationship took time.
Right? Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah. They saw me driving up once a quarter to take Mr. Wallace out to lunch. They saw me come back and get reimbursed for those steak dinners that I was buying. There was probably some bantering about it. Okay, when are you going to come back with a check? It created some grit for them because they I'm sure they were frustrated at, you know, at times about something, because I was constantly on the road. I wasn't much older than 26.
But we live in a culture now that I feel like we are constantly looking for that quick response, that quick, like, I think we live in that culture of social media, of Twitter, of all that's going on right now. And I think, to your point with the 27-year-old, is that's the way they've grown up, it's a quick response. And so I do think, and that's something I'm seeing, is if it's not a quick gift, they're ready to just kind of move on, and they don't see the importance of that long-term relationship. And I do think, and I think you've said this, you know, it's not, you know, even if we're on a dating app, typically we're not swiping in donors, right? We're having to actually build that relationship. It's a little bit old school, I would say, versus the swipe. And I don't even know what these people do these days, but my point is that takes time. And I think COVID has, in my case, I have literally had to say to donors, I am sorry, I feel bad right now because you and I haven't built this relationship and I'm about to ask you for something that I typically wouldn't ask you for several more visits, if at that. Yeah. And I've had to say, but times are hard right now and I'm going to ask you something about a gift. And I think that's, again, just being quite honest with them and saying, and I think I've already built some great relationships with donors with that honesty. But again, it's a long-term process. Yeah. And we have to be willing to understand that. I think that's going to be the new normal. I'm optimistic that as a profession and as a career, and hopefully it's trickled to the board members and the CEOs, that when, excuse my language, shit hits the fan,
we
need to make sure that we're building those long-term relationships for the future if this happens again, which is, it's going to happen again. We're in a new normal.
Yeah, it's happened. I mean, I've been in the field a little more than 2 decades. You've been around a while too. And when I think about what has played out in fundraising, it started with, I mean, shortly after I stepped into this line of work and was started getting my bearings about what this was going to look like, September 11th hit us in the gut. And that changed our sort of way of thinking and changed our paradigms, and it slowed down, you know, consumer confidence tanked. And so approaching your donors like consumers just wasn't working because they weren't going to give that way if you just thought of them as buying and selling goods and services. Then the recession in 2008 happened, same thing. And now COVID happens, same thing. And so if we don't recognize these sort of ups and downs in our economy, Erica, you really wrapped it up really well. I think what you just described there was grit. the way that you interacted, the way that you described that convert, being able to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, times are hard," and usually I wouldn't be this forward and this bold, but that's gritty, and I think we live in a gritty world. And this has been an extraordinary conversation. Erica, if somebody wants to reach out to you, they know how to find me. They want to reach out to you. How would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn. Erica Ellis at Make-A-Wish in Central and Western North Carolina.
Erica, I look forward to having coffee, having lunch. I'll be in the Charlotte area at some point. But in the meantime, we can meet here. You're always welcome back.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.